I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Think back to the days before the iPhone, typing text messages on a keyboard instead of a screen, listening to your music on your iPod, printing maps off the computer before taking a trip, and using mobile internet as a novelty instead of a necessity. Well, it's safe to say we've come a long way since then. Now, there isn't a day that goes by where we don't interact with a supercomputer in our pocket. We use these devices at home, in the office, in the car, at the gym, even at the dinner table. In fact, I bet you're using your smartphone right this very second to listen to this podcast on your favorite app. Well, back in the day, BlackBerry was the first name in the smartphone industry, servicing corporate clients with trailblazing email and internet browsing capability. But a certain Steve Jobs and Apple changed everything, and BlackBerry's dominance proved to be short-lived. Was their demise caused by a lack of vision, poor decision-making, or just the inevitable rise of a tech juggernaut? To talk about these questions and more, we're speaking with Nilay Patel. He is editor-in-chief of The Verge and host of their Decoder podcast. We'll explore the impact of smartphones on our society and what the future has in store. All that's coming up next.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Nilay Patel, welcome to Business Wars.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Before the iPhone, BlackBerry really dominated the early smartphone space. Safe to say that the typical BlackBerry customer was a business person, or is that just sort of the stereotype?
No, I think that's pretty safe to say. They had been making some inroads into the consumer market, notably the children and teenagers who had parents in the business world were all hot on BlackBerries, and you knew a lot of those folks. But really, the BlackBerry was built as an enterprise messaging device, and so it required carriers to support it directly, to support BBM, the messaging service. And that meant it was fairly costly and you required a different kind of plan. And that just pushed it towards the enterprise where there was a lucrative market of business people who wanted to pay for it.
I think it's important to talk about that idea of the BlackBerry being sort of tethered to the carrier, right? I mean, that was kind of critical when the iPhone came along. The BlackBerry needed its partnership.
Yeah. To be fair, the iPhone needed a lot of partnership help at the beginning as well. And to this day, the handset market and the carrier market are inextricably wrapped up into each other. But yeah. BlackBerry specifically was built for much older cellular networks, much slower cellular networks. And the device and the service were very much designed to not use a lot of data. And so there was just a lot of proprietary technology there, both in the device and at the network level, that enabled the BlackBerry to function on networks that no one would want to use today.
You remember CrackBerry, right? Everyone used to talk about CrackBerry. Did you ever get hooked on BlackBerry, or did that come along? Was that before your time or what?
You know, I was a Sony Ericsson and a Nokia person.
So you're
kidding.
Back
then, yeah, back then you had to pick a tribe. So I was deep into the Sony Ericsson world. They made the Walkman phones. I thought they were just the coolest. And then my first smartphones were actually Nokia phones running an operating system called Symbian, which had almost no penetration in the United States. They were huge in Europe. And I think I went that way just to be different. But certainly the, you know, I think the Blackberries were very much an East Coast phenomenon in the beginning. They were heavily used in government on Wall Street. And as just as they began their consumer push and started spreading out across the country, the iPhone arrived.
Yeah, let's talk about that moment. It was 2007, the iPhone hits the scene. And I think a lot of folks thought, well, this is sort of an iPod with a phone built into it. At least that was the way it was sort of reduced. But it ended up being more transformative than the iPod was with the MP3 player, right? I mean, how did this sort of change the profile of the typical smartphone user, do you think?
You know, the first iPhone was not a huge success. It's easy to forget that. So the first iPhone came out, it was fairly expensive compared to all of the subsidized phones that you could get from the carriers at the time. You had to pay $400 or $500 for it, depending on the storage. It was only available on AT&T, which was a big deal. It was not available on the other big networks at the time. And you kind of needed to be bought into Apple's vision for it. And the vision was very compelling, right? Here's this touchscreen device. At the time, a 3.5-inch touchscreen was just massive. And, you know, just doing the pinch to zoom at a party would draw a crowd. It was remarkable.
At the same time, a lot of people forget there wasn't an app store in the beginning. You got what you got.
Yeah, there wasn't an app store. It had a YouTube app. It had a Google Maps app. Apple and Google were very tied up into each other at that time. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was actually on stage when the iPhone was introduced. He made a joke about Apple and Google merging without merging. Now, of course, they're massive competitors.
Right.
But it was a pretty limited device. It wasn't until about a year later when Apple dramatically restructured how the pricing would work, opened up the App Store, allowed other applications. That combination of elements, right? The subsidies from the carriers, lowering the price, the changing of the plans, the cell plans, and then the App Store. That's what really propelled the iPhone into where it is today. So in that first moment, it really felt like Apple had done something remarkable, but the window was still open for others to compete.
It really did feel and seem revolutionary that you had that whole screen to work with, right? I mean, prior to that, you just had half screens if you were lucky.
Yeah. You know, Steve Jobs famously, when he introduced the iPhone, he showed off all of the other popular smartphones on the market. They all had plastic keyboards. They all had small screens. Touch screens at the time were all based on a technology called resistive touch screens, which meant you had to physically push the screen layers together. It was bad. No one loved it. You often needed a stylus. Apple pioneered a technology called capacitive touchscreen, which just registered your touch. That was a big innovation. They pioneered multi-touch, which allowed you to use multiple fingers. They patented a bunch of user experiences based on multi-touch, like side to unlock. The bounce scroll was an Apple patent for a long time. So they had really reinvented a lot of things about the phone. And, you know, the market at the time was really used to plastic keyboards, half screen styluses. So there's a pretty big question over, are people going to accept this much change? And I think Apple's bet was, yeah, that market is pretty small and our product is better. And when the actual smartphone revolution comes, people are going to want what we have because they don't have any of these expectations.
I think that's really an important point too, because if you think about the evolution of this technology, you know, beginning with pagers, doctors, you know, that sort of, they would have a pager. Professionals, attorneys, they would have a pager. And no one really aspired to a pager unless you wanted to show off how powerful you were, right? Then you have the BlackBerry that hits the scene. And the BlackBerry, there is a certain aspirational element, in part because of the status that it sort of conferred. This wasn't a brick. This wasn't a Nokia phone. This was something that professionals used. But with the iPhone, it seems like what you're doing is you're sort of opening this up to people who would never imagine necessarily carrying around a phone before. Nowadays, it's impossible to imagine anyone not particularly caring about whether or not they have a smartphone. They're an essential part of life. But The iPhone seemed to crack that somehow. Now, little kids wanted an iPhone, you know, teenagers certainly wanted. And it seems like, you know, ancient history, but we're only talking 2007, 2008.
Yeah, that first moment of smartphones, if you just really think about what they presented to you, the user, a lot of plastic buttons, a keyboard, and then what you were looking at was a pretty plain interface. And you were really had to think a lot about how the interface of a Windows mobile phone worked, or a BlackBerry, or a Symbian phone from Nokia. Like, they were operating system. They were heavy. They were in your face in a way that just got in your way. They required you to think about them mm-hmm. quite a lot. The iPhone, you know, the genius of the iPhone is that you could just start tapping on it and it would do stuff. And then you could push that home button and start over. And that just sort of like single path to things that you might want to do, a single path to looking at photos, a single path to looking at your text messages, a single path to the YouTube app, and you can start over. I mean, that is classic Apple Steve Jobs genius there, where instead of making you think about the operating system of the phone or the metaphors by which it was working, you were just thinking about what you wanted to do. Every new product, there's always a tension between the metaphor of how it might work mm-hmm. and what it might actually do. And the iPhone skipped over a lot of steps there in a way that, frankly, very few companies are able to achieve even to this day.
It's instant satisfaction, right? I mean, that's what you're tapping into, is this desire to be satisfied without something else getting in the way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think also, you know, Apple knew that people were carrying around a cell phone and an iPod at the same time. And they knew that eventually the cell phones would integrate music functions one way or the other. So they had a big competitive threat that they were hyper aware of, and they needed to solve this problem. And they solved it not by just, you know, doing the licensing deal with Motorola that they had tried and failed at. They solved it by leapfrogging the entire market, which was a gamble. And I think they knew it was a gamble, but they were very confident in the product at the time.
Since we're in a podcast, naturally, we have to talk about the connection between iPhone and podcasting. I know you have the podcast, your own podcast, of course, the Decoder podcast. I want to talk about Apple devices playing, wouldn't you say, a huge role in sort of taking podcasts mainstream, because podcasts had been around long before. I can remember hearing one back in 2003 or 2004. Do you think that was an intentional strategy from Steve Jobs?
You know, I don't know. I think this is going to be one of those questions that we will never know the answer to. Steve Jobs very famously demoed podcasts in the early 2000s on stage at the D conference to Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher. And he was demoing the podcast functionality of iTunes on an iPod. And you go back and watch that demo, it is literally a trip through time to just think of Steve Jobs, the guy who puts out the iPhone and the iPad. And here he is talking about podcasts and like using desktop iTunes to download podcasts onto an iPod. But that's, you know, at that time they saw that opportunity for the iPod. The iPod business required music. They had the iTunes store. They were thinking about how to expand the range of use cases for the iPod. Mm-hmm. Podcasts looked like a rich line of opportunity. It was democratic. Apple has always been pretty good about letting anybody publish into their podcast catalog. And so I think they started with podcasts as, what else can you do on an iPod besides listen to music? And there are lots of ideas there, but podcasts are audio. They, you know, as everybody listening to this now, right, they play that same role that radio plays in your listening habit. So it was just a very natural extension of what they were already doing with music.
This sort of all underscores, though, just how much BlackBerry was back on its heels with the introduction of the iPhone. And, you know, you think about being a fly on the wall when, you know, in BlackBerry's headquarters when the iPhone is released, and all of the possibilities. Is there anything BlackBerry could have done differently, or was it game over as soon as Apple came into this space?
You know, the most incredible thing about BlackBerry at that time was that they thought it was fake. They thought the iPhone demo was faked. So the co-CEOs, Mike Lazaridis and Jim Belsley, they thought that Steve Jobs had faked the iPhone demo when he announced it on stage, because they could not conceive of a phone with the processing power and battery requirements and network requirements they were so familiar with, they could not conceive of a phone, a mobile device, doing what the iPhone was doing on stage. It was just not in their brains.
Nilay Patel is the editor-in-chief of The Verge, and he's been covering tech for more than a decade. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the iPhone's influence on our culture. Stay with us.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind.
Hey, welcome back to Business Wars. Our guest today is Nilay Patel. He's editor-in-chief at The Verge and host of the Decoder podcast, which covers tech and business. How would you say the relationship to our phones has shifted over the past 15 years or so, Nilay?
You know, I was just saying that the CEOs of BlackBerry couldn't conceive of the iPhone, that they thought it was fake. And I have always thought about what their frame of reference in thinking about our relationship to our phones. They were trying to make a phone bigger. What Apple accomplished was making a laptop computer smaller. And so that shift in thinking about a mobile device and what it could do, our entire worlds now go through the phone because they are our primary computing device. I think most people still do not think of their smartphone as a computer, and more importantly, their main primary computer. And that shift, all of your computing is done with a device that travels with you. You just see how it ladders out into everything else over time and how it shifts the culture, right? We all have smartphones in our pocket with expensive cameras in them. You would never put a camera in your bathroom. You just wouldn't do it. You happily carry 3 to 4 cameras on your smartphone in the bathroom with you everywhere you go. You would probably, I know a lot of people who do not want to put an Alexa or Google Home device in their bedrooms. They don't want microphones in their bedrooms. You take a whole bunch of microphones in your bedroom every night with your smartphone. That integration of all of those features into your primary computing device has radically shifted our relationship, not only to computers, but also to one another, right? Because the thing it sells to you is connection. I firmly believe that you can walk up to anyone in the world and ask them about their phone and instantly connect with them and have a conversation, because you're not really asking them about their phone. You're asking them about a device they have to care for. They have to not drop it and keep the battery charged. It provokes emotional reaction in everybody all the time for reasons good and bad. It provides connection to other people. Sometimes it's frustrating. Sometimes it's joyful. This one little object has become the central point of connection to almost everything we do because it is the most important computer in our lives.
Is it that we don't think about it Is it that it provides so many, you know, sort of a Swiss Army knife convenience that we sacrifice some of the privacy considerations that we might have with, say, Echo Dot or Google Home devices? What accounts for the fact that we are not very reflective, and yet we're quite reflexive when it comes to our use of the iPhone, or for that matter, these days, it's quite often a Samsung phone, a Galaxy phone?
The two main things are people love connection and they desire it and they seek it out. The reason you use your phone is because it allows you to talk to other people. And whether that is actually on the phone or whether it's on FaceTime or whether it's reading tweets or whether it's watching YouTube videos or listening to a podcast, there's something very personal about the connection a phone offers you. It's in your hand. It's very intimate. And I think that there might not ever be another product that feels that way for people. There are lots of attempts. There's a lot of conversation about what that product might be. But I think the phone, what it represents in terms of just connection, is the combination of convenience, portability, and intimacy. It's very hard to see what will replace it anytime soon.
You know, you were talking about that connection. It's not just consumption of messages. It's also production. I mean, a lot of folks are on YouTube doing terrific vlogs that are heard by millions of people and making a ton of money at it, too. I mean, this has opened up all sorts of new enterprises just because it's here.
Yeah, I think one of the most radical shifts in the past decade of smartphones has been the arrival of the camera is a democratic mainstream device. And what I mean by democratic is suddenly everyone has a really good camera all the time. Mm-hmm. You might have had a camera before. You might have had a little point and shoot. You might have had a little 35 millimeter disposable camera. But the steps to go from I'm using that to I'm taking a great photo to I am displaying that photo to lots of people, mm-hmm. for most people, all those steps are totally closed off. The iPhone and every other smartphone has now made it so that you have a great camera. You can use it at the drop of a hat to take extremely high quality photos and videos, and the software will help you do it in a lot of ways. TikTok is really just a very powerful video editor, right? It's an incredibly powerful distribution tool, but the other half of it that doesn't get as much attention is that it's a great video editor and it helps you make those videos. So now everybody has that tool. And then, because everybody has a phone, everyone's viewing the content on the same devices it was created on, which historically has never happened before. Right. That is not how technology has ever worked in the media before. People with broadcast cameras do not watch television on the broadcast cameras. But the phone has collapsed that relationship and I think made it not only easier to understand, but more democratic, because if you're watching somebody else who's made a video on their phone, you're holding the same tool that they used. And that means you are that much more likely to try to use the tool to make the thing that you just watched.
What you're really describing is a kind of Gutenberg moment here that we haven't really paused to reflect on perhaps adequately. Do you think anyone at Apple was seeing how revolutionary this device would ultimately be? Or was this about getting phones into the hands of potential buyers first and foremost?
You know, I know the folks at Apple pretty well now. I think Apple will be the first company to tell you, yep, they've got big ideas, but they're always narrowly focused on, is this product that we have on the shelf today great? And is it making people happy? I think they were as surprised by the social media revolution as anyone. Mm-hmm. They did not think these companies were going to take off. They did not think that, you know, Facebook would come to dominate our political and cultural conversations the way it has. I think they have a pretty thorny relationship in particular with Facebook and Google. And I fundamentally, that aspect of the smartphone revolution has nothing to do with Apple, right? It's something that they want to be walled off from because it only offers them opportunity to blow it, right? If they start having Facebook problems, the Apple sheen goes away. And I don't think they have any interest in Facebook's problems.
Do you think smartphone technology has peaked? Is there still white space for innovation in this market?
I do think there's space for innovation. I think the radical steps forward that we were used to for several years there, those have started to come fewer and farther between. But if you just think about a phone, what is the most important innovation any new phone could offer you? The battery could last longer. And we're not there yet, right? Like you still have to care for it. You still have to charge it. Apple made its phones thicker this year, the battery lasts longer. They're selling more of them than ever. The second, and I think ultimately more important innovation that is yet to come is that they've now reached a point where they're kind of too big. Right? I have an iPhone 13 Pro Max. It is just a giant surfboard of a phone. There are new display technologies coming around, right? Foldable displays, Samsung is shipping them at scale. So the size and shape of these products is kind of up for grabs again in a way that it hasn't been for quite some time. So I think that combination of things, what do they look like? How do they work? How do they fit onto your body or in your pockets? And then can we make them last longer?
One of the things that we've seen persistently in business wars, whether we're talking about smartphones or guitars or cars, what we've seen is that you have a dominant player. Well, once upon a time, it was BlackBerry and then, you know, toppled by Apple with its iPhone. 10 years from now, do you still see iPhone right there at the top? What do you expect 10 years from now if you were to look into the crystal ball?
You know, I think in the phone market, I would expect Apple to remain right there. And it's interesting in comparison to BlackBerry, because BlackBerry had the advantage that Apple has right now. BlackBerry had a closed proprietary messaging system that people loved. They had BBM. And getting people to give up BBM to use another platform was very hard. I know people who carried an iPhone and a BlackBerry for a time because they would not give up BBM.
Wow.
Apple has that today. They have iMessage. You could make a great folding phone with all kinds of features. The last thing people are going to hold on to is their blue bubbles, especially in this country. In other countries where Apple does not have messaging lock-in, in Europe, in China, in Japan, you see switching between the platform much, much more frequently. If you're not tied into that messaging platform, yeah, you can go get a Samsung phone and try that for a while because your friends are still all right there. In this country, for sure, iMessage is dominant and it creates a kind of lock-in that, you know, Apple once had to defeat with BlackBerry. So until that changes, I've never seen anything that might change it here in the United States. I think Apple's position is secure.
Yeah, and yet, I guess you can't say never in this case because, well, look at the example of BlackBerry. A lot of people were just as locked in to BlackBerry's proprietary technology, right? I mean, and yet the world turned.
But they had to invent an entirely new paradigm of phones, right? Like if you just think about it from a very basic sort of business school case study perspective, Apple had to offer a vastly larger set of capabilities to draw the customer away from the thing they valued the most about their old product because they were actually reducing the utility of the messaging feature. So that's hard, right? It's hard to imagine, I'm going to make a phone that has more utility than an iPhone. That's what any competitor would have to do.
Nilay Patel is editor-in-chief at The Verge. He's also the host of the Decoder podcast, which covers the intersection of tech and business. You can check out Decoder wherever you get your podcasts. Nilay, thanks so much for talking with us on Business Wars. It's been a real treat to get to say hello.
Oh, yeah, I've had a great time. This has been really fun.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Next week, we get into the holiday spirit. Sort of. There's nothing cheery about the battle between Hallmark Channel, Lifetime, and Netflix. These three networks go to battle to see who will rule the festive TV landscape. Join us for Christmas Movie Wars, December 1st. From Wondery, this is episode 5 of iPhone versus BlackBerry for Business Wars. If you like our show, we hope you'll give us a 5-star rating and a review, and be sure to tell your friends, too. Follow Business Wars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus. You'll also find some links and offers from our sponsors in the episode notes. Supporting them helps us keep offering our shows for free. And there's another way you can support the show, and that's by filling out a small survey at wondery.com/survey. Don't forget to tell us which business stories you'd like to hear. I'm your host, David Brown. Kelly Kyle produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Additional audio assistance by Sergio Enriquez. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.